Hello, and once again, welcome to Minbar. There is a claim that Western countries, especially Western secular countries, are more tolerant than the Islamic East. And there are many Muslims living in the West who actually attest to that. You would hear them saying that, for example, in, I don't know, maybe Syria or Tunisia, they didn't have the freedom to worship as they had here in America or Canada or England or wherever they might be, and that the system there is much more tolerant, much more quote-unquote Islamic even, than the systems that they had left. One of the main reasons or the main ideological reasons for this particular claim is the idea of what we know as religious pluralism, which is something that has been very much discussed about in academia and has in fact become almost a way of life in the West. Now, this religious pluralism comes along with certain ideas and certain attitudes that for Muslims in Muslim countries and in Islam in particular might cause some problematic reactions. For example, along with this religious pluralism is the idea of the privatization of belief and the relativization of truth. Now, like all Western ideologies, religious pluralism of the Western variety is now poised to spread out to the East because, as we know, most Western ideologies are very evangelistic in their nature, like communism, like capitalism, like democracy, secularism, and now in this case, like religious pluralism. Now, before they start spreading out, first of all, they have to criticize negatively the culture that they want to change. And so you find now that the religious pluralism of the West is being shown as an alternative that is much more tolerant and much more progressive than the religious tolerism that you would, or pluralism that you'd find in Islam, if there is one. This is the question we want to try to get at today. It seems that this religious pluralism is very much closely related to secularism, which again is the belief that religion must stay out of politics because especially in a multi-religious environment, you need an impartial referee between religions rather than somebody who reflects one religion or the other and wants to impose it upon others. And so with the push of religious pluralism into the East, along with it would come secular ideas, because this is exactly what religious pluralism is actually talking about. So the questions you want to ask in this show today is religious pluralism a more just or more impartial attitude towards religion in a multicultural society and a multi-religious world than Islam? If there is an Islamic version of religious pluralism, what is it? And what is the effect of religious pluralism on Muslim societies? To answer these questions and explore them deeply, we have with us our honored guest, Professor Dr. Muhammad Leggenhausen. Dr. Muhammad Leggenhausen studied and got his PhD from Rice University in Texas, I believe.
Yeah.
And right now, he has taught in a number of Western universities, American universities, and at the present time is an instructor in comparative religion and Western philosophy at the Imam Khomeini Research Institute in Iran. He has also published a number of very interesting books, among them, Contemporary Topics of Islamic Thought, Jesus Through Shiite Narrations, a translation of the book on philosophy by Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, Philosophical Instructions, and a translation of the poems, the mystical poems of one of the greatest mystics of our time, Ayatollah Imam Khomeini, in this small magazine called The Jug of Love. I'd like to welcome Dr. Mohammed Leggenhausen. First of all, Dr. Leggenhausen, religious pluralism, could you give us a definition of it, or pluralism, first of all, I would presume?
When people talk about pluralism, particularly religious pluralism, depending upon the background they're coming from, they use the term with different meanings. Sometimes I've seen people who are coming out of a political studies background or sociological background use the term religious pluralism in a specific sense with respect to a society. So they say that this society is religiously pluralistic, or religious pluralism is accepted in a society when that society is able to accommodate a variety of religions within itself and afford the adherents of those religions more or less equal rights.
So pluralism is an attitude of accommodation of other religions or of other different points of view or cultures, for that matter, because I've heard of like cultural pluralism, for example.
That's right. But this is only one of the meanings of religious pluralism, although I think it's the one that you come across most commonly in reading newspapers and popular literature. In philosophy, however, the term religious pluralism has a somewhat different meaning in philosophy and philosophy of religion and theology. There, people have been more specifically concerned with issues of salvation and whether salvation is open to non-believers as well. For a long time, the Catholic Church has held a doctrine called, in Latin they use this phrase, extra ecclesia nulla salus, and that means that outside the church there's no salvation. And this, a very strict interpretation of this, was attacked in the 1960s during the time when the ecumenical movement started, and gradually various Catholic theologians and thinkers started to take a more accommodating attitude specifically towards Protestantism and then towards other religions as well. So pluralism, the discussion of religious pluralism in legal theory, sociology, political theory, and most newspapers that you read, is talking about the condition of the society. Is that society welcoming towards a variety of religions or not? But in the theological setting, religious pluralism was much more focused on this issue of who gets to go to heaven. Is it only for one specific religious denomination, or can people outside of that denomination also be saved?
Now, to what extent would this decision in the 1960s by the Catholic Church, where they explored tried to accommodate the idea of other people going to heaven, to what extent is that rooted in their religion? Is there any basis for that in their religion, or is it because of change, the change of the times, that has provoked them to impose this particular idea upon their own religion?
Well, no, I don't think it's just a matter of, I mean, of course you could say that the change in the times has provoked various religious thinkers to start exploring more deeply the reasons why the anti-pluralist attitude was so dominant for so many years. But I don't think that we should say that that Catholic theologians who took a more pluralistic line, like Hans Küng, for example, or Karl Rahner, that they were merely reacting to what was popular or current intellectual fads or something like this. I think that the theologians who have been moving towards ecumenism deserve a lot of respect, and that especially towards Islam, it took a long time for them to come to terms with the idea that people who were Muslim could really find divine guidance in their faith. And there's still a lot of resistance to this idea in among many Catholics and many, many Protestants as well. Although you can find theologians, Christian theologians, who are taking a much more open attitude towards Islam. But the first step in generating discussion about this idea of religious pluralism came with this ecumenical movement, and then gradually, and the ecumenical movement started out of this tension between Catholics and Protestants mostly, and then expanded to discussions of other religions as well.
Now, one is aware of a certain kind of pluralism among Muslims, and sort of a certain type of Islamic pluralism. When you look at Islamic history, for example, you see a very accommodating type of attitude towards people of the non-Islamic faiths. And we also have a certain type of pluralism that is dominant in the West that tends to be not based upon religion per se, in the apparent sense, but based upon more social convenience in terms of trying to get people together. Are there many types of pluralism? Is there one type of pluralism? How can we separate between these pluralisms?
There are very many different kinds of pluralism that we can discuss. You know, if we try to analyze the idea of religious pluralism, we find that among all the different theologians and philosophers who discuss this issue, the question comes about the values that a religion is held to have. And pluralism occurs when somebody says that some key values that religions are supposed to have are shared by a number of different religions. Now, which values exactly and to what extent they're shared creates a variety of pluralisms. So, for example, suppose that somebody's a Buddhist and they hold that the value of religion, considering Buddhism to be a religion, is that it provides peace of mind. Now, if somebody has this kind of attitude about Buddhism, he might say that, well, I'm a pluralist about other religions because I believe that you can also gain peace of mind through Zoroastrianism or through Islam or through any other kind of religion. But usually the Buddhist will hold that, you know, it only gives you a certain degree of peace of mind, and if you really want to get to the tops in tranquility, then you really should follow the Buddhist way for the last stages. Now, if somebody holds this kind of pluralism, with respect, this is only an example, but with respect to any of the values that religions are held to have, then what we find is something like a degree pluralism. So somebody might say, well, yes, all of the religions are good because they provide, for example, social order. Social order is a value. Religions can be valued because of their ability to provide social order. But somebody might claim, but our religion provides social order to a much better degree or to a higher degree than other religions. So we can divide what we might call a degree pluralism from an absolutist pluralism. There's a real interesting book about religious pluralism by an English philosopher named Peter Byrne. And Peter Byrne picks out three different values: access to God, salvation, and I forget the third one. And he says these are what's really central to a religion. Then he claims that if somebody's going to be a pluralist, they should hold that for all the major religions, they're absolutely equal with respect to these values. Now, if somebody
takes... That's why you get absolute pluralism.
Yeah,
equality
pluralism might be another term for it. That they hold that the religions are absolutely equal with respect to some preferred set of values. But this is kind of difficult. It's going to be very difficult to come to a judgment about this, that, well, can you really say that these two or several religions are all on a par with respect to...
God.
Yeah, right, with respect to access to divinity or not. Certainly from a perspective within any of the religions, that would be a difficult position to hold, for most of the religions hold that their own creed, that their own system of belief and practice provides better access to God than alternatives do. Even if they're willing to accommodate the other ones and say, no, we agree that these various other religions do provide somebody with the ability to have some kind of access or contact with God, but not as good as the one that we have. Yeah. Mm. So this provides a kind of degree pluralism, as well as this being this strict equality or absolute pluralism. Most of the philosophers that I've looked at in the past who have spoken about the religions and their development have generally held some kind of a degree pluralism. But the issues become confused because lots of times these distinctions between the types of pluralism aren't kept straight. So you have somebody who has in mind how the society should be ordered and what kind of rights should be available to people who hold different beliefs. And this provides a strong motivation for somebody accepting a kind of equality among the religions. This is certainly what the result of what happened in Europe in the 17th century. They came up with the Treaty of Westphalia, in which all of the princes would each pick a religion. Each one would be free to pick whatever religion he wants, and all his subjects would be able
become
to
that religion.
Become that denomination, and then there shouldn't be any more war in between them. And then over the centuries, this evolved to the idea that became enshrined in liberalism, the religions and religious affiliation should be protected from interference by the state. And
how did that relationship come about? I mean, the state itself chose the religion is going to follow, and then that religion has to be protected from what state? That very state that chose it?
What happened was in the course of time, various of these states combined and formed greater regional states. Mm. Germany, for example, originally was a whole bunch of little kingdoms. So each local kingdom, the prince would pick his religion. So roughly half of them were Lutheran and half of them were Catholic. But then when Germany wanted to become a nation in itself, there had to be some kind of accommodation between them. Mm. So what they did was they said that, well, the Bundesrepublik now allows there to be two official religions, which is a Lutheran and Catholic denomination, but they also accommodate other religions within the Republic. And different countries in Europe have taken more or less similar histories. Like, there's been an official religion that was picked in that country, but then because of the fact that there were many people living in the country that didn't abide by that religion, the state made allowances for the people who had other religions that lived within, who were citizens of that country.
To what extent did religious pluralism, the color of religious pluralism, influenced by these types of political developments?
Well, I think that what happens is that then when you look to the philosophical or theological side of the issue, because there was this tension, this tendency in liberal theory to allow anybody to choose of their own free will by virtue of their own conscience, whatever religious affiliation they wanted to have, there was a kind of tendency to try to accommodate that also in theological theory as well. Mm. And the clearest example of this kind of tendency, I think, is what you find in the writings of the Presbyterian theologian and philosopher John Hick. And John Hick really made the topic of religious pluralism and this phrase, religious pluralism, popular in theological writings and among philosophers of religion. I don't know, I don't think that before John Hick the topic was at all popular. Mm-hmm. And his attitude towards the issue was that, first of all, he was focused on the issue of salvation, and he wanted to argue very strongly that people of many different faiths could find salvation. And this is a difficult position for him as a Presbyterian to take, because the general attitude of Christians was that the only way to salvation, as I mentioned, the Catholic Church had this doctrine, is through the church. For Protestants, at least there was the idea that somebody should participate in some way in the sacrifice of Christ alayhi salam on the cross in order to reach salvation. So if somebody didn't believe in the salvation of Christ on the cross, it was really difficult for these people to find a place in their theological theory of how can that person get to heaven. Mm. On the other hand, if
just
they...
Just hold on with the other hand, because we have to take a quick news break, and we'll be right back after a few minutes. Welcome back. And we are talking with Professor Muhammad Leggenhausen about pluralism, Western religious pluralism. And incidentally, he wrote this book, Islam and Pluralism, which basically covers all of the major issues connected with this particular subject. And we were talking about John Hicks. John Hicks is one of the major proponents of religious pluralism, popularizing the term. And to what extent did John Hicks color the whole attitude towards pluralism?
John Hick has had a very significant influence on debate, especially among Christian theologians, about pluralism. In the course of his discussion, he's been led progressively closer to a theological position that in some ways is closer to Islam than the kind of version of Christianity that he was beginning from. For example, one of the books that Hick edited was a collection of articles called The Myth of God Incarnate. And this created quite a furor among Christians, yes. Because his thinking was like this. He said, well, look, if we agree that God would not reserve heaven just for Presbyterians or Christians, and he would allow good people of faith from other religious traditions to have salvation, then what are we to do with this Christian doctrine that Christ died on the cross for the forgiveness of sins, and somebody has to participate in that sacrifice in order to be saved? And Hick's answer was, well, we have to consider this to be a myth. Christ is not the Son of God who died on the cross to forgive sins. Instead, Hicks said, we should look at Christ as being a religious leader who was showing up one of the paths to God. So in this way, Hicks' understanding of Christ, or Hicks' Christology, as they say, is much closer to an Islamic Christology that holds that Jesus Christ, alayhi salam, is one of the major prophets, one of the people who leads the people to God, but not an incarnation of God.
But wouldn't this like fall right in with Hicks' ideology that, for example, religions could be divided up into, for example, doctrine and also this airy-fairy kind of attachment to reality? And among the doctrine, you have myths and so forth. For example, it might be a difficult thing for him to dismiss also as myth that Islam is the last and final religion to mankind, for example.
Yeah, I think that Hicks certainly would have problems with that as well. I don't want to suggest that Hicks became a Muslim. Mm-hmm. But what I do want to suggest is usually when Muslims look at this, at a figure like Hicks, they try to decide he's a good guy or a bad guy, he's on our side or not. Mm. And I think that this is very superficial, and we have to look at figures like this and say, look, they have a lot of points to make that are in harmony with the position that Islam takes on some of these issues, and there's parts where they disagree as well. And we have to be aware of both of those sides when we consider this. Hicks was focused on the issue of salvation, and he wanted to say that all of the religions, all of the major religions, not all of the religions, but all of the major religious traditions, all are equally ways through which a person can achieve salvation. So in this sense, going back to the discussion we had earlier, Hicks' kind of pluralism is a sort of equality pluralism. That is, he's holding that these different various religious traditions are equal with respect to access to God and salvation. Hicks is very, very much concerned with saying that the religious traditions, therefore, are all equally valid reactions to divinity, which is something that is so transcendental and ineffable and indescribable that all of the religions can be seen as equally imperfect attempts to try to come to grips somehow with that transcendental reality.
Now, this seems to reflect the current type of attitude towards religions you find in the West. Everybody tends to, more or less, tend to look at religions as equal to each other. Maybe today, after 9/11, they might see Islam as a little lower than the others, but they tend to see them as equal. What is the basis for this view? Did Hicks research all the religions? Did he participate in all of them? What is this just something that comes out of the top of his head? What is the basis for this point of view?
It has a long tradition. Hicks himself claims to have been very much inspired by Kantian philosophy, in which all of the appearances that we see are different ways that the human being is able to conceptualize an ineffable reality as it is in itself. So according to Kant, we can never understand reality as it is in itself, but only through space and time and the conceptual apparatus that we have, we become familiar with the world of appearances. Now, Hicks very much was attracted to this idea of Kant in philosophy, but he tries to apply it in religion as well. And he said, so then if we take this basic idea that Kant had about reality, and instead of reality talk about God or ultimate reality being God, then we could say that all of the religions, each one of the religions, is another conceptual framework for trying to grasp that which in itself is ineffable and indescribable. This was the philosophical basis that Hick was using to approach pluralism. But again, I have to emphasize that this kind of pluralism is something that most of the people in the West, they don't have much information about this. Most of the people who are talking about religious pluralism in the West are coming at it through a political framework. And that's much different than this kind of theological ideas. Mm. In some ways, it seems like Hick's theology is a way to provide a theoretical underpinning for the prevalent idea in liberal societies.
In the political environment.
Yeah.
So secular society, which is liberal society.
Yeah. Right.
So are we saying then that this contemporary religious pluralism, this religious pluralism of Hick, is basically the moral component of a liberal secular society with respect to other religions? That gives it its justification, right? A theological
component more than a moral component. But what I try to argue in this book is that what Hick's trying to do is to find some core elements that you can find in common among all of the religions. And because these core elements are present among all of the major religions, we can say that all of these major religions are equal with respect to the chief values that he's talking
about.
What
are the core elements he's talking about here?
For Hick, one of them is to provide a moral system. Another one is to provide a means to salvation. Another one is to provide meaning for life. So these kind of issues, Hick finds that we can look at all of these various religions and we find that each one of them has an answer to these problems. So we find a key that's common among all of the religions. Mm. And then he wants to say it's that key that makes all of these religions equally valuable.
Okay, now I don't see, for example, God. You know, like for example, when Islam defines what makes a believer, you know, and indeed when it defines what makes a religion, you know, God, angels, heaven and hell, the day of judgment, you know, prophets, and so on, right? I don't see any of these types of core things here. What I see is really results, really, you know, order in society, salvation, peace of mind, you know, these are results. So in a certain sense, a psychoanalyst, you know, or a therapist could be seen as the proponent of a religion, if one might say so.
Well, I think that Hick would protest. I mean, he would say that no, I'm not willing to grant the status of religion to anything that's going to give you peace of mind or something like this, because one of these core elements that he wants to indicate is some relation with the transcendent. Mm. And in psychoanalysis, they're not trying to connect you with anything more transcendent than your subconscious.
Right.
But what I wanted to get at here was that the attitude that Hick takes towards it is that what will enable us to achieve salvation through a variety of religious traditions is something that all of the religions have in common. And this is what I refer to in the book as reductive religious pluralism, because it's trying to take the issue of religious pluralism, of the plurality of religions, the variety of religions, find one element that's in common to all of them, or a group of elements common to all of them, and then claim that the things that are value in religion, like salvation, are achieved because of these common elements. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that in Islam, we can also find a version of religious pluralism, if you like, but it's not reductive in this sense. That is that Islam also recognizes that people might take various different paths, but certainly it doesn't consider all of the paths to be equal, so it's not an equality pluralism. And it's not claiming that the path that somebody takes, that different people take to achieve salvation, has to be through some common element that they all have. And that is, there might be religions are recognized in Islam despite the fact that there are significant differences with Islam. So, for example, in this famous story about this delegation of Christians from Najran who came to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and they were invited to become Muslim, and they didn't want to have anything to do with it, and then the Prophet issued them an invitation. He said, well, you gather your people and I gather my people, and we stand before God and pray for God's curse upon those who lie. Now, in this story, notice that nobody curses anybody. Mm. The Prophet said, if you want, you come with your people, I'll come with my people, we'll pray for God to curse whoever's lying about this issue. According to some reports, some people came to the Christian delegation and said to them, if he comes with his soldiers and people like that when you gather at this place, then you go ahead with the
imprecation.
But if he comes with his family, then you know he's being sincere, so then don't go through with it. So when they went, they saw that he's with the Ahlul Bayt. He's with his son-in-law, Ali, alayhi salam, and Fatima, and Hassan and Hussein, alayhi salam. Then they understood that, well, if he's really willing to pray that the curse of God should come down upon these people that he loves so much, he can't be insincere about this. Now, of course, they didn't have any doubts about their own sincerity. So then they went to the Prophet and they said, okay, we accept that you're being sincere. We don't have to pray for anybody to get cursed by God. The reaction of the Prophet to this admission on their part was to say that, well, let's have a peace treaty then. And in the peace treaty, I will guarantee personally your lives, your property, and your religion. This aspect of the Prophet guaranteeing the religion of the Christians of that time. Now, the Christians of that time were people who believed in Trinity. They were people who were not believe, they believed in incarnation of Christ. Right. These are things that are opposed to the doctrines of Islam. And yet the Prophet said, I will protect personally, I will guarantee your religion.
What can one say then, that there is a common point here, there's a common point here that has led him to make this decision, that, for example, they do believe in Hazrat Isa, who is a prophet of God that Islam has accepted, and that they have a gospel, even though the gospel has been distorted, that they have a gospel so that in some way, and they do believe in the Day of Judgment, they do believe in angels, they do believe in heaven and hell, and so forth, so that there are common values and beliefs that they hold together?
Yeah, there are common values and beliefs, but the Prophet didn't require them only to, or didn't protect only what was common between them. Mm. He offered his protection for their religion the way they have it, with the disagreements and the agreements. And this is something that I think you can only find it in Islam, this kind of accommodation towards other religions. At least in the history of Judaism and Christianity, especially in Christianity, there isn't this kind of theological basis for the acceptance of the other religions that you can find in Islam. So it's much easier for Muslims to hold some version of religious pluralism than it is for Christians.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm talking about is religious pluralism in the theological sense, not the political, social
right.
form of religious pluralism.
Yeah. So, is there any indication that there's any kind of political agenda in Islamic religious pluralism?
Is there an agenda in Islamic religious pluralism? Well,
it's basically theological, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, also it has to do what happens also, then you have to start looking at the treaties that were formed with the people of the book
right.
at that time who were going to live in Muslim controlled areas. And they were required to pay a tax called the jizya. They were given a status of zimmi. At the same time, they were not required to defend the Islamic territories, even though they were living in the protection of the Islamic territories. And all of this kind of political outcome was something that grew out of the, you might call, Islamic religious pluralism. Mm. But what I'm trying to focus on now is the theological problem. Contrary to the kind of theological position towards pluralism that you find in somebody like John Hick, who's looking for a basis of strict equality because he wants to, I think that there's some tendency that he has to want to make the theological position correspond with the liberal tradition in Western societies. Instead, in Islam, what you find, instead of this reductive, what I was calling reductive religious pluralism, you find in Muslim understanding, there's much more willingness to accept the idea that somebody else that we don't accept their belief, even we consider their belief to be off from the right course, but still that person, despite having wrong beliefs in some ways, wrong rituals in some ways, is still capable of being guided through that faith that they have. And I always think of the story of Moses and the shepherd in the Masnavi with respect to this issue. You know, in the Masnavi, Molavi talks about this shepherd. And the shepherd is praying to God, and Moses is very close by, and he hears what the shepherd is saying. And the shepherd says, "Oh God, I want to rub your little feet, and I want to pick the lice out of your hair, and I want to make you warm and take care of you." And Moses, after a while, he just can't stand it anymore. And he jumps up and he says, "What's the matter with you? God doesn't have little feet. God doesn't have hair and lice and all of this kind of thing." And the guy says, "All right." And after, you know, he's coming to grips with this, what the prophet told him, an angel comes to Moses and says, "What are you doing? Why are you bothering this guy? God said that this guy was worshiping him, and you're interrupting the worship. He was really sincere in his worship and everything, and this was very pleasing to God." So I think that the attitude that's displayed in this story about Moses and the shepherd is that even though somebody has completely wrong idea about what God is, wrong idea about theology, still, if that person is sincere in his belief, that could be most pleasing to God, despite the mistakes involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how is it that somebody like Molavi was able to write a poem like this? This is an expression of the attitude within Islamic society.
Right.
I don't think that you could find a poem like expressing that kind of attitude coming out of Christian society in the 17th century, for example.
And that is why you would find that perhaps people like Hick and others tending to have to go outside of their religion, within the outside of the dogma of the religion, to be able to create that type of environment that is so natural for religion to be in the sense that being able to see the overarching rahmat, the overarching mercy of God as it applies to all people, regardless of faith, but not necessarily on an equal footing.
Mm-hmm.
We're just about out of time, and I want to thank you for joining us today. And hopefully this is a very open subject, a very deep subject that cannot be understood and exhausted in one setting. And I hope that, God willing, Professor Langenhausen will give us some more of his time, that we can explore the areas of pluralism. What we came to find out today is that Islam is a pluralistic religion, but it is not a pluralistic religion that reduces all religions to one. It is a religion that is based upon sincerity and based upon accepting those who accept the truth. We want to thank you for joining us here at Minbar, and look forward to seeing you again, same time, same channel, next week. Goodbye.